Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Topher, Principal Architect of Topher Architecture, and you are listening to New Books Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network dedicated to architecture and its publications. If you have any suggestions on authors who you would love to hear me speak with next, feel free to send me an email at btopher@topherarchitecture.com. Today's guest is Stuart Walker to talk about his book, Design and Spirituality, A Philosophy on Material Cultures. Stuart is Chair of Design for Sustainability at Lancaster University, where he also co-founded the Imagination Lancaster Design Research Lab. Thank you for being here with me today, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me, Brian.
Oh, anytime. So before we begin, can you tell the audience a little bit more about yourself?
Well, a little bit about my background. I come from originally from Wales, from the industrial valleys of Wales, and it was a very industrial valley. The valley floor was lined in a huge steelworks, and lower down the valley were coal mines. So it was very much that kind of industrial valley heritage of Wales, which has now largely disappeared. But I worked in the steelworks in my summers as a boy, as a student, and then I studied mining engineering when I went to university. I did my first degree and then my PhD in mining engineering. And I worked then in the oil industry for a number of years as a petroleum engineer with an oil major in Holland and the Middle East and back in the UK. And through those experiences, I really became aware firsthand of the impacts heavy industry is having on the planet. And I saw a lot of countries and I saw those impacts, and I decided I wanted to change direction. So in my early 30s, I stepped away from that industry and I went to art school to study art and design. And then from there to the Royal College of Art in London, where I started dealing more seriously with design for sustainability.
Very interesting career path. We'll have to talk about that a little later, of course. And so we'll just jump right into the book. So the question I think we could start with is, you know, the book is very unique in its format. You and I discussed this. You know, there's 64 chapters, and a lot of them are kind of very unique subject matter. However, you know, what is the overall theme of the book? And I mean, you had mentioned, is what is the reason for this unique format and kind of this almost disparity between chapters, even though they all tie together?
Yeah. Well, as you say, yeah, there's a lot of different, very varied chapters in the book. And I wanted to write the book in a way which I felt was in keeping with the subject it was about, which is design. The main theme of the book is design and spirituality. And both those aspects of ourselves, design, whether it's architectural design or product design or other forms of design and architectural design, are imaginative processes. They use spontaneous methods as much as rigorous systematic methods. Often serendipitous processes occur in the process. So being creative and imaginative, which spirituality also is, it seemed like a good way to try and develop a book on those themes in the same way I would go about designing an object or something, where ideas, I've got a general idea, I will approach it in a rational, systematic manner. But I also have spontaneous thoughts, serendipitous occurrences, and they all contribute to parts of the design. And eventually, they all are put together to make up a whole design. And that's basically the way I put together the book. So there's there's a whole variety of different parts, if you like, in the book. There's short essays, personal reflections, more systematic academic writing. There are photos which illustrate some of the concepts I'm talking about. And there's even some poetry.
That's right. Yeah, I can say I have not read an architecture book with a poem in it yet. So that's a first. All right, thank you. And so, you know, kind of one of the overall themes that comes up a lot, and so that could be our, where we start with as well. You bring up the fact that, you know, we live in a very advanced time. We use technology. I'm quoting you. That seems like it's right out of a science fiction book. But there's enough data to show that the reality is that happiness is actually in a decline, particularly in affluent regions like, you know, United States. And so this idea of spirituality and kind of, I will say, like, inner transformational more, I know it's important. And so I'd love to hear you explain a little bit more, I guess, just that concept, the idea that happiness is declining despite our improved quality of life.
Yeah, well, all the evidence shows that, actually, which seems surprising, mm-hmm. but actually shouldn't be surprising, particularly if you're aware of the major spiritual traditions in the world, not just the Christian tradition in Europe and much of America, but all the Abrahamic religions, the Eastern traditions, Taoism, Buddhism, and so on. They all have a fairly similar message about our relationship to material things, and tell us that wealth and riches and material things are not the path to happiness. In fact, they advocate quite the opposite. So I was thinking about those things, and being a designer and predominantly my area is product design, and seeing all these innovations and products that come upon us, that are advertised to us, that we're we use in our everyday life, and we're constantly being encouraged to buy more of, and designers design those products, then there seemed to me to be a conflict between the way we live and the kind of messages that we get every day through advertising and marketing, and those messages in those spiritual traditions. So one of the reasons I wrote the book was to explore those connections, and particularly because of my research over many years in design for sustainability. And sustainability means not just environmental care and responsibility towards the natural environment, but the more fulsome understanding of what sustainability means is things like social justice and social equity, as well as environmental care. And really, that starts with us as individuals. That starts with our own values, what makes us tick, if you like, and the major spiritual traditions are about that, really. The major spiritual traditions teach us how we should live in the world and the kinds of values that enable us to live well in the world. So spiritual values, things like benevolence, which is thinking about other people, charity, environmental stewardship, all those things can affect the way we do our activities today and can inform the way we do our activities today in terms of the products we produce, the products we use, and the nature of those products. And as you know, we live in a highly competitive world of production and innovation and growth. But that growth, and the reason why we're constantly pursuing innovation is to enable growth. But unfortunately, most of the growth, or much of the growth, the economic growth in Western-style economies is based on consumption, individual levels of consumption. And those individual levels of consumption, whether they're products or whether they're services, they have an impact on the natural environment. They take the resources out of the ground, which, and when we mine resources, when we drill for resources, when we transport resources, we impact the natural environment when we put pipelines through or when we put highways through, and we drive away the wildlife. We trash habitats, and wildlife populations go down. And we are constantly eroding and reducing the amount of natural environment there is because we keep on building on it and tarmacking it over and encroaching on it. And that ultimately affects our sense of well-being, because there's a lot of evidence to show that exposure to natural environments and being in nature is actually good for our own well-being. So we're actually hurting ourselves in the long term, you know. So all those things, those conflicts started to resonate in my mind. And I thought, well, what if I try to explore some of those things in a book through writing a book?
Absolutely. And kind of to piggyback off that, you do have a chapter that talks about the fact that we use a lot of metrics that are not outdated, but just irrelevant. The one that speaks to me is you talked about the gross domestic product and how everyone uses that as a signal of economic strength, whereas you just said, everything we do is based on growth and consumption. And so while the GDP could be rising, a lot of social states could actually be declining.
Exactly right. Yeah, I mean, GDP goes up when there's a major environmental disaster, for example, because you spend money on it. So it's good for the economy. So that doesn't make any sense at all. So there are other ways that we can measure the state of countries, and it could be, you know, based on education levels and social services and the proximity of people to natural environments and their availability to them. So there's all kinds of other ways that we can measure our success as countries and as regions. The gross domestic product has been in play for a long time, but it's a very crude and often self-defeating kind of metric. As far as I'm not an economist, but these are the things which seem to be the case. And so a number of countries have developed other kinds of measures to look at this, including the United Nations, which has come up with other kinds of measures.
Absolutely. And so maybe we can't go into all of them. You had listed a few that I was unaware of. The one that I think me and everyone else may have heard of is, you know, the happiness index, which I believe has a better term. But you have listed a few others. And so you also mentioned the same idea with intelligence, that standardized testing of the IQ is kind of the same thing, where there's other factors such as emotional and some other factors. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little more.
Well, you know, standard measures of IQ are often about answering kind of rationalistic questions, which require certain kinds of answers. There are lots of other ways of knowing and lots of other ways of experiencing the world, which designers are very, very aware of. But they're outside that kind of rational, systematic approach to our education system. So more intuitive, subjective ways of knowing. And they're important, and they're critically important for creative disciplines like design. But they're also important for areas such as spirituality, which are about human values. They're not about facts in the way that science looks at the world, in terms of facts about the physical state of the world and natural phenomenon. They're about human values and ethics and what we value and why we value it and how we should live to live in a good way. Our philosophies and our spirituality are about those things. And design is really a combination of those more imaginative ways of knowing and obviously values-based ways of knowing combined with the kinds of more factual information that science can bring to the table. But I think what we must be clear about, as we develop products and as we develop innovations, we are, I mean, might not be so aware of it, but we are making value judgments. When we take a scientific discovery, a phenomenon about the natural world that science has put on the table or discovered, and then we decide we can make use of that for human purposes, perhaps for human benefits or for other reasons to make a lot of money, maybe, then we have made a value judgment about it, about its value, and we've combined, if you like, facts and values into a new technological innovation. And there's values being included in those developments, which we may or may not recognize. But that's the case. And so we have to look at, okay, what are those values? What are those values that are driving those kinds of innovations? And how do those values square with more traditional teachings about how we should live?
Speaking of that, particularly science, you know, you had mentioned you're talking about the value-based decisions. You know, at one point, I think it's worth discussing, you talk about the fact that there is a big difference between the aims of science and technology, and it does get a little muddled, and I think the example you provide about the insecticides is a great story to hear more about. And so, you know, you mentioned the idea of science, the pursuit of knowledge, technology is the application of the knowledge. And that doesn't, at first, that doesn't seem like a huge difference, but then the story you provide kind of sheds a bigger light on that.
Well, you know, what we are really good at, I think, in our education systems, and our different departments and faculties in universities and so on, and our departmentalized corporations and businesses, we're really good at going deep into particular areas and analyzing and coming up with good rationales for doing things. We have a problem, we look for the solution, we've got the fix for it, and then we roll it out. What we're not so good at doing is joining up the dots and looking beyond our area of specialization and seeing, okay, what are the potential impacts of doing that beyond these short-term benefits of, you know, eliminating this particular insect or pest or whatever it is. What may be the knock-on effects be of that in the short term, in the long term? And, it was that kind of thing which actually began the modern environmental movement with Silent Spring by Rachel Carson back in the early 60s, when she showed the relationships between DDT, which was sprayed liberally everywhere to get rid of unwanted pests, and then those dead pests were being with a food supply for others, and then they were for the food supply for others, and you get this process of bioaccumulation where these toxins build up, and eventually those animals die, and so. We see that with in all kinds of other places today, not just with insecticides, but with waste plastics which go into the sea and so on, and they get broken down into microplastics, and they get eaten by small organisms, and then they get eaten by larger organisms and so on. You get that process of bioaccumulation, which is really detrimental to other species,
right?
And eventually to us if we eat the fish, for example. You know, so there's these knock-on effects because we're not joining up the dots. We're not looking at the picture in a more holistic way, in a more synthetical way, and seeing how do these things interrelate. And this is one of the joys of trying to look at it from a design perspective, because design as a discipline is less, it's not so much an analytic discipline which goes into depth on any particular area. It's a more what I call a synthetical discipline, which takes information from many different areas and many different areas of expertise and brings them together to create some kind of holistic outcome, which hopefully works on all the different levels. So design is a really good way to try and address these kinds of issues, because it naturally, it's a discipline which naturally brings things together, brings people together, brings expertise together to try and see how these things all work together.
Absolutely, I agree. And so you had mentioned kind of the role of design. And so one thing that maybe we would have talked about in the beginning, you know, the idea of spirituality is brought up in the book a lot. It's even in the title. You've mentioned it a few times. And there is certainly religious imagery in the book and in your stories, for example. But I think what would be worth elaborating is, I think your definition of spirituality is maybe a little different than what came to my mind at first, and probably to some of our listeners' minds at first. You know, I know it sounds like very literal, like religious design, but at least from my opinion, the book doesn't exactly, it's not a design book on designing for religious structures. It's actually almost the furthest thing from that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I take quite an open attitude to what I've been trying to do is look at the not one. I was brought up in the Christian religion. Mm-hmm. But in this book I open it up to consideration of other traditions, and there's extracts and there's references in the book to the Tao Te Ching and mm-hmm. to Buddhism and to the Bhagavad Gita from Hinduism and many other traditions, because they all appear very different on the surface, I think, those traditions. But when you drill down to some of their essential teachings, they're remarkably similar. And the golden rule, for example, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, is present in virtually all the major spiritual traditions. That's why it's called the golden rule, because it's a fundamental precept about how we should live in the world. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Right.
You know, and in the Christian tradition, it's love your neighbor is another way of saying it. Although that other way of saying it is there as well, and so it's not strictly adhering to any one form of organized religion. It's looking at spiritualities around the world, what they have in common, including traditional knowledge and indigenous spiritualities, because they offer particularly North American indigenous peoples have a very close relationship to the natural environment, and the land in their traditions is sacred, and to violate that is sacrilegious. And so they've been very close to the land until very recent times, and there's a lot to learn from the way they created their material culture, and how those forms of material culture were in complete synchronicity with the natural environment. They didn't violate the natural environment. They didn't pollute the natural environment. And they were kind of moderate, resilient forms of material culture. And so there's a lot to learn from all these different wisdom traditions or spiritualities, whatever you'd like to call them, from many, many different cultures. And it's a real rich area to be inspired by how we can live today, how we can learn from those traditions in order to do things today which are less polluting and less intrusive and more considerate of the natural environment and of people.
Great. And so, speaking of tradition, you had mentioned, you know, you mentioned North American indigenous. And so in the book, you do make the case that with technology, we are more connected than ever, but that there is kind of an erosion of traditional knowledge and tradition itself. And I'd love to hear your take on that a little more.
Yeah, well, we've been aware that the traditional approaches are in decline all over the world, sadly, before we've really understood what their contribution can be. I'm pleased to say that that contemporary scientists are taking a far closer look at traditional knowledge these days to get a better understanding of how they can learn about environmental science from that more holistic point of view I was talking about earlier, because indigenous ways of knowing are often much more holistic in their approach. They're not split up into little separate, you know, entities of knowledge. They're all put together. And so we've been doing some research, myself and a colleague at Manchester Metropolitan University, into traditional material cultures, and particularly traditional craft cultures in Britain, in Cumbria, just north of Lancaster here, and in New Mexico in the United States, in the Santa Fe area and north of Santa Fe, and in China. And we've found there's a great deal of knowledge and expertise to learn from those traditional ways of doing, which are often incredibly resourceful, very imaginative, and deeply meaningful, and they build human skills and knowledge. And those skills and knowledge are passed down from one generation to another. We've also found that with the people we've interviewed, why they do what they do, their motivations and their values align very, very well often with the spiritual teachings and spiritual values. The people we interviewed, they were less concerned with the kinds of things that we hear about so much in modern society: innovation, economic growth, wealth generation, all those things. While they were business people those things were considerations for them, they weren't the driving forces of what they did. They seemed to be far more concerned with their community, with creating good work for people in the community, and contributing and giving back in some way to their community. And they're also usually very deeply environmental in their thinking. They use gentle processes, a lot of natural materials, and are concerned about doing things well, not just doing things quickly or efficiently. You know, efficiently, we're very preoccupied with efficiency in modern society. Well, that's not necessarily a major concern for a lot of craft makers. They don't want to necessarily do it efficiently. They want to do it well. They want to do it effectively and well. And as I say, some scientists are now paying far more attention to these traditions and this kind of knowledge to inform their work in environmental science, which is very encouraging, I think.
Absolutely. What I was going to say is, and you kind of already hit my next question, you know, mass production is often touted as, you know, big innovation of our time. And you kind of had the argument that a lot more holistic communities actually don't mass produce, and that there's actually benefits to not mass producing items. I think you've touched on most of that already. What I wanted to ask about is, you know, most of the book talks about design as a general form. However, occasionally your product designer background kind of slips in. And so you have mentioned specifically the idea that products, specifically, there's a bit of an unethical approach being taken. And, you know, you make the argument for less mass production, maintenance, repairing, upgrading, etc. And so I guess, I know for me, that's a very jarring thought at first. And I have to imagine for a lot of people, the idea of not mass producing goods, they'll all have the same thought: no one can afford it then. Whereas I thought you made a decent argument that it could work if we didn't mass produce our goods. And so I'd love to hear you prove that to those who were just as jarred as I was.
Well, yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there when you say we couldn't afford it. And that is a very telling comment, because if you say, well, I can't afford it, if we don't mass produce it, I can't afford it. Then you think, well, okay, if I can afford it, why is it so affordable? And the reason the object is designed as it is, the reason the object looks like it does, and the reason the object is affordable is because the way it's produced, which is mass production. But the cost, the retail price of that product does not reflect the cost of that product, the true cost of that product.
Right.
Because it doesn't include the social cost of exploitative labor in developing countries somewhere which are paid poor wages, which has led to a lot of suicides and very awful conditions for a lot of people. So we can enjoy affordable products in our country. So that's part of their affordability, is that exploitative practices. Mm-hmm. If they aren't exploitative practices like that, then they might be robotic practices, which is putting people out of work, or people are reduced to sort of very repetitive forms of work, and all the skilled work is done by the robots, which is not good work for people, and also takes a lot of energy and so on. So it increases energy use. And it also doesn't include the costs to the natural environment of taking those resources out of the ground, the decline in natural places. It doesn't include the particulates being emitted into the air, the energy being used. It doesn't include the transport and the highways and the pollution caused by that. It doesn't include the dealing with the packaging and the disposal of that packaging. And of course, when those products are made cheaply on the other side of the world somewhere and are imported to our countries in a one-way distribution system, and many of these digital products we use last maybe 3, 4, 5 years, and then we replace them with updated models, and then those disposed of models, they go somewhere. Those old products go somewhere. And they often go to landfill, or they're incinerated, which creates more problems. And so none of those costs are taken into account, which allows those products to be as affordable as they are. Mm-hmm. So those retail prices do not reflect their true costs. Now, when that system is expanded globally, as it now is, and when the goal is growth, so it's doing more of that more quickly all the time, then we have got a recipe for eventual disaster, because what that means is that we start designing products with built-in obsolescence, which has been around for quite a while, so that we deliberately design them to fail after a certain point in time, so that we have to replace them. So we are deliberately creating trash. And all that energy, all those materials, all that shipping, all that packaging is for nothing, because we're soon going to be trashing it and throwing it away, getting a new one. And so you can see when that's a growth curve, an exponential growth curve going up on a finite planet, that can only go on for so long before we start hitting something which is saying, actually, maybe we need to rethink this. And I think we're at that point now. And we've been at that point for some decades, actually. So we have to start doing something about that. And one way to do that would be to think about different ways of producing our products, and thinking about how an economic viability for businesses without producing and selling more products. And there are other models for producing some products, yes, but long-lasting products, well-made products, easily maintainable and repairable products. And there are economic models, which is a product service model, where instead of the more money you make is based on the more products you sell, you can have an economic model is the more money you make, the fewer products you sell. And you make your ongoing money through service and repair and upgrade and so on over time. But you're not constantly dependent on selling more and more products. And a number of companies have gone that route. Interface, which is a US-based but now international company of office flooring, they completely changed their model a few years ago under Ray Anderson, the CEO, to a more environmental model. And it went from a carpet selling business to a product service business that now offers a service of immaculate office flooring. And they maintain that over time. And there's a number of other companies that have done that in the past and are doing it now. Companies like Xerox, for example, you don't have them so often now, but Xerox photocopiers in offices, if it's a product service model, they put the model into the business and maintain it. So every time they have to call out a service engineer, it costs them money. If the product is long lasting, low maintenance, really reliable, they get the same service fee, whether they're maintaining it or not. So there are other kinds of economic models we can look at where there's far less throughput and much more resilient products, long-lasting products, repairable products, easily maintainable products. We need to give those kinds of solutions a lot more consideration these days, I think.
Very compelling argument. I think that's a great explanation of what I was asking. And in fact, it kind of perfect segue into kind of one of our last points. You had mentioned, you know, the economy needs to change. And you specifically mentioned that there has been a recent event that has forced us to reexamine some of our economic elements, that specifically being the COVID-19 pandemic. One example you give is, you know, the supply chain is always producing just enough. And now we've seen that when that gets interrupted, everything goes to hell, for lack of a better term. And so what I wanted to ask, however, is I often ask, you know, what has everyone been up to since the book came out? You say in the book that you were 6 weeks into the pandemic while writing it and that you'd be curious to see, I guess, how things shake out in the future. And so, you know, roughly 48 weeks have happened since then, the pandemic. You know, you make the case that the COVID kind of proved that we're not as happy and spiritual with all our technology. And so, with this extra year since you've written the book, do you feel that that's been validated? Do you feel differently?
Well, I think it has in many ways. I mean, I think it's shown some of the advantages of technology, not least communication, which has enabled us to keep our businesses going, our teaching going at university. I've been doing all my teaching online this year. And it's allowing us to have this conversation. So there are many benefits of being able to communicate globally with others with similar views, with different views, and to understand ourselves better. But I think what the pandemic has shown, particularly when we've been under such long periods of lockdown, that there's more to life than communicating via technology, and there's more to life than, you know, watching movies at home, that we need people, and that community and proximity to people and community and seeing people and seeing loved ones and neighbors is important to us. I think we felt it more than perhaps we ever felt it before during this pandemic because we haven't had it. We haven't been able to have it for health reasons. So I think the pros and the cons have been exposed a bit, and I hope we will reflect on them and think about how we can do things better in the future. I hope we don't just slip back into the same ways we were doing it before as soon as possible and start and just sort of go back to normal, because that normal that we had was actually an aberration in human history, and not a completely unsustainable one at that. So I think as we move forward, we need to think a lot more about making the most of our local resources, our local assets, and create more local, inclusive forms of employment, reduce our needs for transportation. And so we'd also be reducing our pollution and air pollution, particularly through air travel and things like that. Mm-hmm. And finding new ways of engaging at the local level. And if we reduce those things, reduce all those transportation of goods, all those transportation of very short-lived goods, and rely more on locally produced things, it helps reduce public expenditure in areas such as waste disposal and cleanup, which inevitably the taxpayer has to pay for. And it also helps foster all kinds of community-led solutions. And when you have that, you start to have a much more diversified economy. And because it's much more diversified, it's also much more robust and resilient. And it's also much more interesting. But that then, because it's more localized, you can also start feeling a sense of cultural distinctiveness and place-based, context-based distinctiveness. And that helps build a sense of community identity and pride in community, and a sense of who you are, which helps feed your sense of well-being, as you feel you have a sense of belonging. And I think we've missed that. I think we've certainly missed that during the pandemic.
I would agree. And so I wanted to thank you for speaking with me today. I know we've only scratched the surface, but I'd hate to keep you here all day. So
it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
To everyone listening, the book is Design and Spirituality, A Philosophy on Material Cultures. Stuart, thank you again for meeting with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
To everyone listening, thank you and have a great day.